This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live. HRRN
Live. But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Todd Pletcher, somebody who has amassed more than well over 3,000 wins for his career. As a matter of fact, his total up over 3,100 at this point, and somebody who I have approached on several occasions to have on this program. We finally get all the stars to align here tonight. Todd, do you feel somewhat like a highly sought after top recruit trying to be recruited to a specific college?
No, I'm glad that it could finally work out. It seems like juggling the schedule is always hard, but I'm glad I could be with you guys tonight.
Well, it's not like you don't have anything else to do.
Yeah, you're not too busy, are you?
No, actually, if there is such a thing as a quiet time, December might be that way. It used to be before Gulfstream started racing in December. This was the 1 month where things were a little bit quiet for us, but now that's even changed.
Yeah, and people don't realize, I think a lot of times we get caught up in looking at trainers as one-dimensional and just focused on nothing but horse racing. But Todd, you have your wife and children, and a couple of weeks ago, your daughter had a birthday party, so that was the reason that you couldn't come on the show. And I mean, it just shows a whole another side that people don't often realize is out there with trainers.
I tell you, I think sometimes that my schedule is busy, and having three kids in the 8th, 7th, and 4th grade, and what they do with sports and academics and all the extracurricular activities they have, I think actually my schedule is easy compared to theirs sometimes.
Now we know why your wife's a listener, because she's shuttling everybody to these sporting events.
Exactly.
What sports are they into, Todd?
Both my sons are playing soccer. Soccer season just ended recently, and we'll probably play some basketball this winter. And then my daughter's been playing lacrosse. So talk about an exciting afternoon. Go watch one time last fall, I watched four consecutive 9-year-old girl lacrosse games. So it's fun. It's great to watch them play. And so they're all enjoying it, and it's good stuff.
Where did they get the athleticism from? Were you an athlete growing up?
Not really. Not as good as I would have liked to have been. I mean, I tried to play, you know, some sports, but I kind of hit that phase of my life when I was like 14 or 15. When I actually graduated high school, I think I was 6 foot, about 125 pounds. So it didn't lend to fitting in very well, especially growing up in Texas, to be a football player, for example, when we know how competitive it is there.
Well, Todd, as I told you, this show very much about your life, your background, how you got started, some of the things you've had to deal with throughout your career, as opposed to specific horses that you have in training right now. And everybody seems to have that moment that really hooks them on this sport. What was that moment for you? Take us back to the beginning.
Well, I mean, for me, you know, the moment probably just evolved as a child. My dad trained horses from before I was born, so I was literally born into, you know, a racing family, and was exposed to it very early on. I can remember going to the barn with my dad when I was 5 or 6 years old, you know, and just hanging out with him and going out in the mornings, going to the races in the afternoons, and, you know, literally from childhood, always being involved in some capacity. So I don't remember a specific moment that hooked me. I think I was just hooked from the beginning.
Well, you start out like that in the family business, and people have certain expectations of what you're going to be like. And your dad was a very good trainer, but he never had the amount of horses that you have. Talk about the transition, you know, like from your dad's business to what you do now.
Well, I think my dad had tremendous foresight on coaching me and helping me get started. And one of the things that I did after, you know, I sort of had the basics down and was a hot walker for him, a groom for him, and spent some time and kind of knew somewhat what I was doing around the barn, he encouraged me to spend a couple of summers working for other trainers when I got in high school. And he sent me to California one summer to work for Henry Marino, and who's been a family friend for my whole life, and is a terrific guy and a terrific trainer. And so I spent one summer with him, and then spent one summer working for Wayne Lucas in Chicago. And then actually was fortunate enough as a senior in college, being a graduate of the racetrack industry program at University of Arizona, actually got to do like an intern with Charlie Whittingham, where I actually got some college credits for it. So, you know, he encouraged me to do that. He knew that I knew the system that he had at the barn, but he wanted me to get out there and see how some other guys did it. And thankfully he had enough ends to give me opportunities to work for guys like that and get a foundation that, you know, is so hard to get and get exposed to so many high quality horses and high quality trainers and how they operate their business. So that was very, very helpful.
Todd, is there anything that you took from your dad's operation and watching him do things that you still incorporate into your practice today?
Well, you know, actually it's still a big part of our organization. You know, we have a training center in Ocala that he and I own together, and he runs that and breaks all the yearlings and does a significant amount of our layups and such. So, you know, his influence is big there. And the one thing that I really enjoyed growing up and doing with him was going to the yearling sales. And he was teaching me about confirmation at an early age. And to me, one of the most exciting things about buying horses and just training horses, I mean, that's really, you know, our recruiting process. And while coaches are out there looking for good running backs and, you know, basketball players and such, we're out there looking for good athletes as well. And to me, that's the most challenging part, the most interesting part. And, you know, something I enjoy a lot is just trying to learn what good horses look like. And it's a lot of fun and very challenging, always an ongoing learning process.
When we had Tom Proctor on last week, he mentioned that he wished he had worked for other people like you did. He said that was the one thing that he regretted, was he always worked for his relatives, his dad and his uncle. He never really worked for anybody else other than them. When you're working for these other guys and you pick up certain things, is there anything that stood out to you, you know, anything that one of those guys imparted to you that you use in your training methods today?
Well, I think the one part, you know, the very most basic part is just the consistency and the work ethic and the commitment to every day that it takes. And you know, when you look at Wayne and Charlie Whittingham, those are two very different trainers in a lot of ways. And yet the one thing that was very consistent with both of them is you had to get up really, really early in the morning to beat either one of those guys to the barn. And you had to stay really late to leave after they did. So, you know, the commitment is the most basic part of it. And then, you know, as far as training, I think everyone sort of is going to have their own touches. While a lot of things are very basic, and a lot of people are going to do things that are very similar in a lot of ways, and yet it might just be the subtle changes that are going to be the difference in maybe your style versus someone else's. And I think that's something that you don't necessarily learn from someone else. You can watch and learn sort of a system and some basics, but then the specialty touches are something that you have yourself.
One thing that I was so impressed by when I was watching your operation down in Florida, you had like a set of 15 horses come out and everyone was standing there like statues, and the jocks all left the coffee room and went to their horses. It was almost like a race, and you went down and you touched the legs of every horse. And I was so impressed with your hands-on method of going over each horse and telling the riders what to do. And you don't see that in a lot of big barns. And when people want to bring up, oh, you know, Pletcher's got 300 horses and this and that, you know, I often come to your defense. I find myself being your press agent and saying, hey, listen, this guy is amazing. He touches every horse every day wherever he's at. So, you know, I don't want to hear about it. I think it's amazing what you do.
Well, thank you. I mean, you know, we've got a system down, and part of that, I think, is knowing each horse on an individual basis. And, you know, unfortunately, in our line of work, things change overnight. And a perfectly sound horse today might not be that way tomorrow. So we try to be pretty thorough in our pre-training inspections and, you know, might alter what you do with the horse. And so we're always trying to minimize injuries, because there's no way to prevent them, but hopefully we can minimize them and do the best we can with that. But that's always a challenge.
Todd, let's go back to Charlie Whittingham for a minute. You mentioned basically being able to intern with him, so to speak, when you were at the University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. What do you remember about that first time walking into the Whittingham barn there, being a kid just trying to crack into the sport somehow?
I thought it was extremely intimidating, and I obviously knew of Mr. Whittingham and all of his accomplishments, but had never actually met him in person. And so through my dad and Henry Marino, they'd sort of laid the foundation. So I remember going by the barn in Hollywood Park the afternoon that I arrived to sort of arrange things to get started the next morning. And he was very, very kind, very soft-spoken. And I just said, you know, what time should I be here tomorrow? And I remember he said, early. And so I got there at 4:15, and he was already there. And he could not have been any nicer throughout it. But, you know, when you go into a situation like that, and I'd kind of grown up, you know, in the Midwest, and my dad had nice horses, but they weren't world renowned. And so you walk into the barn and, you know, there's Ferdinand and horses like that there that just, it was like, wow, this is, these are the elite of the elite. And yeah, it was a great summer experience. And, you know, he was, very, very generous with information and his time, and could not have been any nicer to me than he was.
You know, when Kieran McLaughlin joined us on the show a few weeks ago, Todd, he talked about D. Wayne Lucas and learning from Wayne, just like you mentioned here earlier. What's your favorite D. Wayne Lucas moment?
There were a lot of great moments there, and we had a lot of great horses and big wins, and, you know, also went through a little bit of a lull during part of the time I was there. So I sort of saw, you know, the peak in 89 when I was there, and then we had a little bit of a lull in the early 90s, and then came back on, you know, huge in the mid 90s. So I saw a little bit of the whole thing, and probably, you know, working with Wayne was an unbelievable opportunity. But I don't know how many people really know that really, and Kieran would probably say the same thing, and so would probably Mark Hennig and Dallas Stewart and a lot of guys that worked there. As much of an influence as Wayne was on us, equally or even more so in some cases, his son Jeff was a huge influence. And I spent a lot of my time working for Jeff, and to me, he's probably the most intelligent horse person that I've ever been around. And the way that he ran the barn and conducted his business was probably the single biggest influence on me in the way that I try to do my business.
Yeah, you say the way that he ran the barn. What did he do that was so special?
Well, he just, you know, he knew everything that was going on at the barn at every moment. He knew what every horse was doing, what every hot walker, groom, every person was doing. And he was a strict disciplinarian that always challenged you to be on top of things and very detail oriented and just, you know, really, really on top of it. And I think, you know, someone like that as a coach or a boss is great to keep you always thinking ahead, always, you know, what's happening and not only what's happening right now, what's getting ready to happen, what we're going to do in the next set, just barn management and horse management, all those things going on at the same time. I thought it was, I was very, very fortunate to get that experience.
Yeah. He was a really focused guy. And I think that's a common thread that runs through guys that are super successful in this business. And you would certainly be among those is being focused on what you do. And there's no question, about it. When you see you going through your day-to-day duties as a trainer, the focus is in your eyes. I mean, you can see you're not really thinking about much else other than the horses and what you're doing with them and how they're training and what they look like when they come back and how they're cooling out. I mean, that single-mindedness, I think, is the hallmark of a great trainer.
Yeah, I think it's hard to have a lot else going on when you're focused in on that, especially when you have a number of horses and, you know, there's so much, especially in the morning training hours, when you think about, you know, really there's a window of about 3.5-4 hours during the morning that really basically everything evolves around. So, you know, that part is so critical and, evaluating everything and preparing for the races. So it's some ways it can be a pretty intense 4 or 5 hours, and in a lot of ways it's very enjoyable as well.
Trainer Todd Pletcher, our special guest on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Todd, you're coming up on the 17-year anniversary of your first winner. Tell us that story of Majestic Number.
Well, I was pretty fortunate to kind of pick her up. I'd become acquaintances with Victor DeVivo and Ramona DeVivo when we were training when I was helping Wayne, and kind of got to know them a little bit, and they said that they had a filly that they would be interested in sending me, and so got started. I think originally with 7 horses at Hialeah, and she was one of them. She had run once before for another trainer in New York, probably about 6 months before that, and got some time off. So she came to us, and she trained pretty well. And that time, I think in her first start, she had finished 5th, beaten 12 lengths or something like that. So that was in a maiden special weight. So I thought we had a little bit of an opportunity maybe to run her for that time. They had a maiden 80 down to 75, and thought she'd trained well enough to maybe win a maiden special weight, but she'd probably be pretty tough in there. So fortunate enough that we ran her there and no one claimed her, and she won and ran her back I think about a month later, and she won one of the vans. So it was a that was big to get that first one out of the way.
Yeah, and more than 3,100 have followed. So unbelievable accomplishment since 1996, a Majestic Number. Todd, one of my favorite portions of these Trainer Talk shows is listening to trainers talk about some of the horses that, for one reason or another, really stand out in their minds. When they look back on their career, for whatever reason, this horse or these horses really seem to stick out. What are the few that, when you look back on your career, you're going to remember no matter what?
Well, I've always said that I thought that the two horses that probably meant the most to getting my career going were Jersey Girl and More Than Ready. And those were the first two really good horses that we had. Jersey Girl was the first grade one winner that we had. And More Than Ready, you know, he really stormed onto the scene in 99, I believe, in his 2-year-old season, and So that was kind of the first time that that I think we had horses that were sort of front cover of the racing foreign types. And, you know, if you can prove that you can train those type of horses and win grade ones, then I think it just it provides you with so many more opportunities. So that those were the two that always stand out to me.
More Than Ready, he's kind of become your version of Bill Mott's Theatrical. Bill Mott said, you know, Theatricals did a lot for him and put his kids through college and everything. More Than Ready's kind of been that way for you.
He really has. A kid, Jim Scatorci, all the time with, you know, now with English Channel and Scat Daddy and More Than Ready out there. I always tell him these are the gifts that keep giving, you know. They're just, you know, they're turned into be really good sires, and it's great to have a breeding right to those type of horses. And, yeah, it's been a lot of fun to see their offspring. And actually with Jersey Town, that was pretty exciting for me to see a horse win the Seaguar Mile a couple years ago that was by Spitestown, who I trained out of Jersey Girl, who was my first grade one winner. So it makes you start to feel old when you see stuff like that happen.
Todd Pletcher, our special guest here on Trainer Talk. Todd, you mentioned I should say this, that Phil Mickelson for a long time in golf was the golfer that was the best golfer never to win a major. He finally breaks through. I think a lot of people at one point considered Todd Pletcher the best trainer never to win a Kentucky Derby. You break through in 2010 with Super Saver. Look back on that experience, and was it just a relief to get the monkey off your back?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because you always envision how you're going to feel after a race, or, you know, dream about winning a race like the Kentucky Derby. And for some reason, when Rags to Riches won the Belmont, that to me was probably the most excited I've been right after a race. I don't know, the history of it and beating a horse like Curlin by a nose and the way the whole race unfolded and stumbling at the gate and all that, to me, that was the most exciting, and sort of just went numb after the Derby when Super Saver won. And I think part of it was because, you know, the buildup had just gotten to the point where, you know, 0-for-25 or whatever it was, and sort of couldn't read anything without it saying, you know, Todd Pletcher 0-for-24 in the Derby. And it's just like, enough's enough. But, you know, I feel like in a lot of ways that our Derby record is not that bad, and now that we have a win, you know, I think it's okay. I think anytime as a goal, you know, we've been fortunate enough like this year to, I think, win 27% of our races. And I know when I worked for Wayne, we always talked about 20% kind of being that goal. So I think, you know, if you can produce those kind of numbers during the year, you're going to be lucky in graded stakes if you can win 15, you know, 15%. When you get to the classics, if you can win 10%, I think you're doing unbelievably well. So our numbers aren't that far off of it, and had a couple of seconds. And it was maybe not quite everything that I hoped it'd be, just because I think of the record leading into it sort of took away from it a little bit.
You're the first trainer that I've ever heard that's won the Kentucky Derby that says, I guess our Derby record's okay. Most guys, you know, they get a custom license plate. They have their tombstone chiseled. You know, they might run 5,000 horses in the Derby to get that one. I think you're very humble.
Well, yeah, I mean, love for it to be better. So all we can do is keep trying.
Well, you got a few chances, I think.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny, Todd, because Doug O'Neill, when he joined us on the show a couple of weeks ago, we asked him if that winning the Derby makes you want to get back there even more. Is there something that drives you that's even stronger inside of you now? Because now you have that taste of it. You know what it's like to be at the top of the mountain. Is that kind of the feeling that you have now trying to get back there?
Well, I think everyone that's been there, you know, or hasn't been there even, you know, wants to get there again. The one thing that I can definitely say from a training perspective is you see how much it means to the owners and how much excitement they get and to participate in the Derby that's the one thing to me that is really rewarding about the whole Derby experience is how much fun and excitement that the owners of the horses get and how much they want to be there. And, you know, for everybody that's walked over there, and that's become a big deal for the owners to do now, and you walk over there and you see that 100,000 people just sort of sitting over on top of you while you're walking over. I mean, it's an impressive scene. It's a intense scene. It's electric. And for the owners to get there, to me, that's as fun as being there myself and the excitement they get, you know, for a lot of people, that's a lifetime moment, you know?
Well, Todd, time flies when we're having fun, and just about 1 minute left here before we have to wrap up this edition of Trainer Talk and move on to Wesley Ward, who's going to join us here in the second half of the show. But just briefly, talk about your wife, Tracy, and what she means to your operation. And I know she works very closely with you, and I know her support has to mean an awful lot to you.
Well, you know, I've often said that probably the toughest job in the racing industry is being a trainer's wife. And, you know, the time commitment that I have at work is substantial. And to know that you have someone at home that, you know, not only is a good spouse, but is a great mother and someone that, you know, like, I don't have to worry about what the kids are doing and they're being taken care of, and that her schedule taking care of three children is crazy busy. And, you know, a lot of times I'm missing out on a lot of stuff that I'd like to be a part of, but, you know, she carries the bulk of the weight there in a big way. And, you know, to not have to worry about those types of things is allows me to focus on the stuff I do. So it's a huge help.
He's trainer Todd Pletcher. He's nice enough to spend some time with us here tonight. Todd, we appreciate it. All the best this year, and we're going to look forward to seeing you down in Florida. Thank you for taking the time.
That was my pleasure, guys.
All right, trainer Todd Pletcher. Great stuff, huh?
Yeah, fantastic.
Wow.
First class guy.
All right, we'll get to a break. We're back with more. This is HRN Live on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Why sell at Basic Tipton summer selected horses of racing age sale?
Market trends.
Current market trends create huge premiums for horses with recent form.
Timing.
The July 14th sale date falls during transition time for stables and provides meaningful racing opportunities for new owners.
Flexibility.
The online catalog only until time of sale allows for entries to be taken up to 1 week prior to the sale date.
Innovation.
The online catalog features updated pedigrees and race records as they occur, along with Rogozin sheet numbers and race replays.
Graduate success.
2013 sales grads are off to a fast start, including Grade 3 winner Candyman E and stakes winners El Sano, Chow Bella Luna, Home Run Verde, and Jay Cito. Last year's inaugural sale was a tremendous success with an average of $105,000, a median of $45,000, with a low RNA rate of just 15%. The Phasic Tipton Summer Selected Horses of Racing Age Sale, Monday, July 14th in Lexington, Kentucky. Nominations recommended by June 2nd. Visit phasictipton.com for more information.
It's been more than a decade since Funnyside became the first New York bred to win the Kentucky Derby. Now, New York has two combatants hoping to follow in Funnyside's hoofsteps.
It's Samrat narrowly, and Samrat will stay undefeated.
So New York bred Samrat and his brave runner-up in both the Gotham and Withers Stakes, Uncle Cy, are both on the road to the Derby while proving that New York breeders are increasingly breeding quality thoroughbreds that can compete across America and around the world. Learn more about our awards program at nybreds.com.
Breathing easy is the key to equine performance and health. That's why horsemen around the world count on Flair nasal strips to protect the lungs of their equine athletes without drugs. Flair Strip's gentle support of the nasal passages reduces the soft tissue collapse that occurs in all horses during intensive exercise. 7 clinical studies prove the benefits of Flair strips for reducing lung bleeding, reducing fatigue, and shortening recovery time. Reduce bleeding, recover faster, perform better. Prevent, protect, perform with Flair strips.
Have you dreamed of owning a racehorse, or have you already experienced the thrill of visiting the Winner's Circle? Either way, the inaugural Thoroughbred Owner Conference at Keeneland has something for you. Expert panel discussions, presentations from Thoroughbred trainers and owners, a day at the races, social events, and even a keynote address from Hall of Fame golfer and Thoroughbred owner Gary Player. Mark your calendar for the Thoroughbred Owner Conference in Lexington, Kentucky, October 13 through 16, and visit ownerview.com today to register. That's ownerview.com.
Nipissing's coming on, and it's Nipissing in the center. Outside, spring in the air. Nipissing, absolutely flawless to win the Woodbine Oaks.
The countdown to the Queen's Plate continues with the Woodbine Oaks presented by Budweiser on Sunday, June 15th. Post time is 1 p.m. The card features the $500,000 Woodbine Oaks and the Queen's Plate trial, plus a guaranteed early and late pick four of $100,000. Visit WoodbineRacetrack.com for details.
This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live, presented by Basic Tipton.
Mike Pennett, Baron of the Backstretch, Jude Feld, he's the pontiff of the pick four. Ready to roll. It's going to be a really fun show as we visit with Hall of Fame trainer Bill Mott coming up in just about 5 minutes from right now. Bill Mott, the ninth trainer in North American Thoroughbred history to reach 4,000 victories. He did that back in 2010. We're going to talk to him about that. We'll talk to him about learning from some of the greats, including Jack Van Berg, who he worked with for a few years and went out on his own in 1978. It was a great decision because, as I mentioned, and everybody knows, Bill Mott now in the Hall of Fame, and he's won countless graded stakes races and, again, more than 4,000 races for his career, probably best known for that run that he had with Cigar for Alan Paulson back in 1995 and 96, winning a record-tying 16 consecutive races.
Yeah, he was on quite the streak and did it at a top level. You often hear people say, oh, this horse didn't, you know, run against the best or that. Nobody said that about Cigar. He was running against the nuts all the time. He was the nuts.
And how about this? Bill Mott has won 9 training titles at Saratoga, 10 titles at Belmont Park, 9 at Gulfstream, 5 at Keeneland, and he's the all-time winningest trainer at Churchill Downs. Set the record for the number of victories at a single Churchill Downs meet with 54 during the 1984 spring meet. So it doesn't matter where Bill Mott has raced his horses, he's been successful, and successful in a big way.
Yeah, that'd be interesting to find out too, how he decides where to go. You know, he's won training titles at so many different tracks, and has he done it simultaneously? Or, I mean, you know,
right? Yeah,
you got horses in Florida, you got horses here.
Well, that's the thing, and not just with Bill Mott, but with so many of these trainers now that have these big strings. He has 100 horses, approximately 100 horses in training right now. And as a former trainer, Jude, I know you never had that many, but how do you keep up with so many horses at so many different locations? I guess you have to have good assistants.
Yeah, well, that is for sure. But, you know, he has 100. Pletcher's got like 300, right?
Yeah.
Lord knows how many Chad Brown has.
Sure.
So, I mean, it's a whole different kettle of fish, you know. But 100 horses is plenty. When I started training, the maximum you could have was 40 on the grounds at Santa Anita.
Really?
Yeah. You could only have 40 stalls.
And they wouldn't, that was it. That was the most they would give you.
Yeah. And the super trainers like Charlie Whittingham and Bobby Frankel, those guys, they would have horses at San Luis Rey Downs or somewhere else, you know, but most people stuck to the 40 on the track. So it's a whole different situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
well, Bill Mott is going to be here with us in just a moment. And again, a man who began his training career on his own in 1978 after working for Hall of Fame trainer Jack Van Berg. It turned out to be an outstanding decision as he is now in the Hall of Fame. He's amassed more than 4,200 victories for his career. As I mentioned, just the ninth trainer in North American Thoroughbred history to reach that 4,000 win plateau, that coming back in 2010. He is a member of Racing's Hall of Fame and winning training titles at so many different racetracks around the country. And how about this? More than $210 million in career purse earnings amassed by Bill Mott trainees. And Bill, nice enough to take some time to join us here on Trainer Talk this evening. Bill, thanks for taking the time.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Happy to have you on board. And Bill, when you hear those kinds of numbers and statistics about your career, what goes through your mind?
Well, just I guess it took more than a week or two to amass those numbers. So it's been a long time coming. You know, it didn't happen overnight. I guess the career has spanned quite a few years, and so there's been some good years and some bad years, but we've been very fortunate to have some very, very good horses to carry us along and kind of horses at all levels to amass that number of winners. But as far as the money figure, you can tell that there's been some good horses that have won the right races, in that group.
Well, we'll talk about some of those horses that have been very special to you throughout your career, but let's start from the beginning. How does a kid growing up in Mobridge, South Dakota, end up becoming hooked on horse racing and becoming a Hall of Fame trainer?
Well, it's pretty easy for me. My father was a veterinarian, so we were exposed to animals and horses, of course, and cattle and large and small animals. And so I guess from a very early age, I would help him with his veterinary practice, whether it be, it was mostly a cattle practice, but we did horses and he worked on horses. And we're talking about farm and ranch horses, and we were out west. So initially it wasn't race horses, but my father was always interested in race horses, and he got involved with the Asmussen family. I guess I probably would have been about 13 or 14 years old at the time. And he and my father and Keith Asmussen bought a couple of race horses together and a few brood mares. And then that's how the job started for me. I went from working on the ranch and helping my dad in the off season from school to going to the racetrack when I was 14 years old, working for the Asmussen family.
How big is Mobridge?
Well, when I was growing up, it was 5,000 people, and I think it's down to about less than 4,000 now. So it tells you a lot of people are moving away from that part of the country. I guess a lot of the young people move away now just because there's, not as much opportunity there. I guess they move to, more populated areas of the country, and it's farming and ranch country, and of course some of the mom and pop operations are going a little bit by the wayside out there, and there's more corporate farming, big outfits coming in, taking over the land, and doing the farming on a much larger scale than what they had in the past. Although it's, still productive area. I mean, the landscape is changing just a little bit.
When you left the farm and went to the track, where did you start out?
Actually, the first year, I worked at Asmussen's ranch for a few weeks before we went to the racetrack. They had a place in Agar, South Dakota, which was about 60 miles away from where I lived. And then, during the summer, we stabled our horses at Attacad Park, which was in South Sioux City, Nebraska. And we raced across the river, and it's kind of a tri-state area that we raced at Park Jefferson. And I guess that would have been back in 66, maybe 67, something like that, 66, 67. And actually, Wayne Lucas was racing there at the time, and he was racing quarter horses, and that's the first time I'd run across him. I guess I was 15 by the time I met him. But so that, you know, Park Jefferson and Aberdeen and Fort Pierce, South Dakota, that was it for me in the beginning.
Lucas was doing the same thing you were. He was taking time off of school to be in the horse business during the summers.
Right. Well, he did. He got a pretty good start on it. I mean, he always ran a, even back then when we were racing at Park Jefferson, I mean, he always had an upscale outfit, and I used to sneak over to his barn and look at his operation and see what was going on. And he was a very hard worker. I mean, he'd be there all day working with his horses and did his own feeding and did everything himself. I mean, he definitely was very, very hands-on and did very well with quarter horses before he moved over to the thoroughbreds.
Hall of Fame trainer Bill Mott, our special guest on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Bill, you mentioned Jefferson Park. Park Jefferson. And that's the place where you won your very first race, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I can't even remember when I was, I guess my first race I won when I was probably 15, and I think my father was listed as trainer because I wasn't old enough to get a license, and I think maybe the next year when I was 16, I was either 16 or 17 when I got my first trainer's license. So, I guess Park Jefferson was probably where the first recognized track that I ran at that I had a winner.
Who was the horse? Do you remember?
Well, the first horse I won with actually, and I think this one was listed as, my father was listed as trainer, was a mare called My Assets. She had been purchased out of a sale out in California, I think, which at the time was at Pomona, which I think now is where they have the Barrett sale. And we didn't cost much. And then Keith Asmussen trained her the first year, and then they had a dispersal sale and we bought her. So my dad bought her for $300, and she had a bowed tendon, and that's, you know, I got her back up to the races, and we ran her at an unrecognized track in Fort Pierce, South Dakota. And she dead heated for the win in her first race. It was a $500 purse, and they had a blanket, a cooler that, you know, the winner got. So because it was a dead heat, we flipped a coin for the blanket, and I won the coin toss, and I still have the blanket to this day.
That's cool.
Wow.
So
it's clear to me now how you amassed over 4,000 wins, because, you know, usually guys that have won 4,000 races are old and crotchety, and you're certainly far from that. You're a very handsome guy. You put on a fantastic appearance in the paddock always, and I was just, when we were prepping for the show, Mike said, you know, it was 4,000 races. I go, he couldn't have won 4,000 races. He's not that old. But that explains that you started, you were like, started at 16.
Early.
Yeah,
started
before
early.
You could drive.
Yeah.
Bill, I mentioned you worked with Hall of Fame trainer Jack Van Berg. Tell us about that and how that all came about.
Well, I'd already been training a few years on my own, just our family's horses. My dad had, you know, had a couple horses, and I actually bought one or two of my own while I was in school. And so I would train them during the summers. You know, I moved on to my junior and senior year of high school, and I trained them over the summer. And I guess, of course, I didn't go to college, so I moved on to wound up. The first year I kind of moved out of South Dakota, I went to Denver, and then through Nebraska, you know, I raced at Centennial Park and then went back into Nebraska, I guess when I was, I couldn't get stalls at the main Centennial Park meet. My horses weren't good enough. So I wound up going to Lincoln, Nebraska, and raced at Lincoln and Columbus and Attica, and then that was kind of my first full year of training. And the next year I made my way to, with a couple horses, I made my way out to Detroit, And the one horse I lost in a claiming race right off the bat and didn't have much left. So I went to work for a fellow named Bob Irwin, who was had been an assistant for Mr. Van Berg, Marion Van Berg, for years. And I worked for Bob for 3 years, galloped horses, and always had a horse of two of my own. And then after 3 years with him, then I went to work for Van Berg, and I worked for Jack for 3 years. So, you know, I learned an awful lot from everybody I've worked for, but particularly Bob Irwin. I think, you know, he taught me an awful lot. I asked a lot of questions, and I think it was good preparation for me. When I went to work for Van Berg, I started out galloping horses for him, and he realized I probably was maybe, you know, a little more knowledgeable about horses and had maybe some, you know, had some miles under my belt already. And he offered me a job as an assistant. He said, let me give you the same deal that I give Frankie Brothers. So Frankie and I were both working at the same time as assistants for Jack. And I did that for 3 years. And then Jack made the move out to California kind of permanently. And I stayed in the Midwest and raced around Detroit and was actually able to keep some of the clients that we had previously. So I then started up a public stable. So that would have been in the fall of like 1986, I believe. And, or no, that, excuse me, that would have been, I lose track of time. That was 79. Certain years are big years in my career. And I guess that would have been the, one of the big ones. It was the fall of 78. And I guess my, first year of training a public stable would have been 1979. You know, where I trained for other people outside horses besides just my own.
Talk about some of the great clients you've had over the years. You've trained for a lot of different people, and you know, now you've got Judmon, obviously one of the great jobs. But talk about some of your clients and maybe an interesting story or two about somebody.
Well, you know, I started out with the guys in Detroit that were, you know, the locals around Detroit, and we, you know, we bought and owned some horses together, but moving, you know, then moving on to Kentucky, you know, one of my first clients was trained for a fellow named W.F. Lucas, who was a Louisville resident, and he only would have two or three horses at a time, but they were always nice horses. He was one of the vice presidents of Brown-Forman Distilleries in Kentucky, and, you know, a great guy. Trained for a fellow named, I had a horse for him. I had Rapid Gray Shot and Miss, Taylor Special, El Puma. You know, all those horses were, you know, Saturday sort of horses. And then a fellow named Mr. Rudder at the same time. These were all back in 1979. Mr. Rudder was chairman of the board of the Fairgrounds Racetrack at the time, and I trained several horses for him, and those fellows were all very good to me and gave me a real, you know, real opportunity with nice horses to start out with, and it just one thing led to another, and I wound up with horses for a fellow named Fareed Sifa, who was from Detroit, from Brighton, Michigan. And he was actually pretty big in the business at one time with, you know, a lot, fairly large stable and mostly claiming horses. But, you know, it gave us the opportunity to be in action and win a lot of races. You know, moving on to Kentucky, I trained for people that I still train for today, people that I trained for in like the early 80s, Dr. David Richardson and Hiram Polk. They're both doctors from Louisville, and they've remained some of my most loyal clients over the years. I mean, and not only good clients, but good friends besides. And you know, Warner Jones had horses with me when he was alive, Hermitage Farm, and I've trained for Governor Jones actually back then. You know, just so many people from Kentucky, but I did very well around Kentucky through the early 80s. And, you know, we won several trainer titles, I guess 8 or 9 trainer titles at Churchill and several at Keeneland. And, you know, I guess to this day we still have the record number of wins and stake wins at Churchill Downs. I don't think anybody's going by us yet, but, you know, a few of them breathing down our necks. But, you know, then in the fall of 1986, I had the opportunity to get a private job with the Firestones, with Burt and Diana Firestone. And that, at that time, you know, I looked down, I'd had really good horses in the barn, you know, in the mid-80s. I had, at one time, I had 3 millionaires in the barn, which I remember back in the mid-80s, there was, you know, they used to publish a list of millionaires in the Blood Horse magazine, just like they would have a list of the top stallions. But they had, like, the list of millionaires, which was probably a list that was less than 25 horses at the time. And I had, at one point, I had 3 of the horses on the millionaire list. I had Heatherton, Cepha's Beauty, and Taylor Special. And they were all 3 of them were on the millionaires list at that time, which was, you know, I thought a pretty big accomplishment. And I think it, you know, an indication of what, you know, the quality horses that I was able to get at that time. But then all those horses were starting to, they were being retired toward, you know, the later 80s, and the opportunity came up with the Firestones and the opportunity to go to New York. So I was reluctant to take the job at the time, but it turned out to be a very good deal. I took the job, went to New York, and in 1987, I had my first Breeders' Cup winner and my first champion, which was Theatrical, which Theatrical was probably and has been and probably always will be maybe the horse that's had the most influence on my career and my lifestyle and my life and my, you know, whether it be, you know, every aspect. I mean, just it really kind of gave me a bump and a head start into sort of the national, you know, arena with, you know, winning the Breeders' Cup. He won 6 grade ones that first year and was voted champion. So he's my first Breeders' Cup winner, my first champion. You know, and then over the years I was able to, have a lot of his offspring that did a lot of good. You know, I've trained, you know, for part of their career, I trained Shakespeare and Royal Anthem and some very good horses. I trained some of the better ones that he ever produced. So, a very good horse you know, I owe Theatrical and the Firestones an awful lot for that opportunity.
Yeah, I read.
And actually the Paulsons owned a part of Theatrical. They weren't, Mr. Paulson, Alan Paulson was, and you know, a partner in him. And that's how I made the connection with Mr. Paulson for later on.
Yeah. And that didn't work out very good for you, did it?
Well, I think I had 5, I think 4 or 5 Breeders' Cup winners for them. You know, we had, Fraze and Agena, Asina and Cigar. And, you know, they were all Breeders' Cup winners and all champion. Or, well, I guess maybe Fraze wasn't a champion, but he was a Breeders' Cup winner, and I had several champions for him. So, you know, that was a long and rewarding relationship with them. And I got to tell you, you know, between the Firestones and Mr. and Mrs. Paulson, Alan Paulson, what a great guy he was. I mean, just, you know, he was, you know, a man's man, he was a real, you know, both families, the Firestones and the Paulsons, were very sporting, loved horses, and, you know, loved to challenge and loved to win. And they liked all the things that I wanted and craved, and, you know, that they always excelled at the top of the game and gave, you know, gave everybody around him a chance to do the same.
Well, Bill, you told me last night when I called you and asked you to come on the show that 25 minutes was going to be an awful long time for you to do an interview with us. And I have to tell you, we're just about done.
Yeah.
We could have spent 2.5 hours with you here.
I didn't allow for many questions, but I get to rambling. But
no, it's great.
I guess you ask about, you know, one thing kind of leads to another, and you ask about all the people and the good horses, and there's just so many of them, and there's so many that, you know, you to mention, and so many good ones that, you know, that I owe such a big part of my life to, and you know, and all those good things led my family and you know, my children and the homes that I've been able to, you know, afford to live in, you know, it's all come from the horses. So, you know, any risk that I ever take with the horses is no risk at all, really, because they've put everything in place for me up to this point.
Well, Bill, just about 2 minutes or so left here before we have to move on. Tom Proctor set to join us in the second half of Trainer Talk from California, but we haven't even really talked about Cigar. You mentioned him one time. Give us your favorite Cigar story during that remarkable run back in the mid-90s.
Well, I don't know. I'd almost have to, you know what I mean, to tell you what's my favorite thing and go through the I'd almost have to go through his entire career with me to give you the favorite story. But, you know, there were a lot of interesting things that happened, I guess, during that point in time. And you know, it was like, after he got on the win streak and we started going from place to place, of course, we had already been to Dubai and won 10 in a row in 1995 and a championship and a Breeders' Cup, which was a very emotional time for me. I mean, I just to have a horse like that was just, you know, it'll almost bring me to tears every time just thinking about it. But we, you know, then going to Dubai and the challenge of going to Dubai and being the first one over there, we didn't know where we were going. Nobody knew where we were going. It was new for me as a person. We didn't know what kind of racetrack we were going to get, you know, involved with. And to have him come out the winner, I mean, it was just kind of a surreal sort of experience. But, it, you know, everywhere we went after that, I mean, some of the most fun places we took him around the country. We took him to Boston, to Suffolk Downs, to run in the Mass Cap there 2 years in a row. We did that both years after we came back from Dubai. So he won his first race, you know, excuse me. He won 2 years in a row, I guess, after coming back from Dubai, he won there again, and that for the second time. But then, of course, we wound up, you know, Chicago, the Citation Challenge, and then we went out to California to Del Mar for the Pacific Classic. And I mean, the people were lined up. We got, you know, we got you know, police escorts from the racetrack. And I remember we unloaded and we were in the barn. We were in Shoemaker's barn out in California when we took him out there, and people walking around. We had guards at both ends of the barn just, you know, to keep people from going through. But some girl had come through with a clipboard, looked very important. You know, everybody probably thought, well, maybe she's with the racetrack. Who knows? She's with media publicity. I guess you can, if you take a clipboard and a pen and walk through someplace, you can almost get anywhere. This girl was walking through, the Cigar had been put in his stall, and this girl was walking through the Shedro, and, you know, nobody paid too much attention to her. And all of a sudden she got to Cigar's stall and she ducked under the webbing, grabbed a handful of feces and put them in a jar and ran out of the stall, ran out of the other end of the barn. And it was like, did anybody else see that? Do we really believe what we just saw? And so it was, you know, there were some pretty strange things that happened, but I didn't know that, you know, people were quite into those type of souvenirs. But I guess, you know, rather than a lock of his hair or, you know, a horseshoe that came off of him during one of his big races.
Yeah, how about a bridle?
Enough. They got, something hot. They got something that was, you know, hot and warm, you know, with a nice aroma.
Well, Bill, you have to promise to come back on with us again here in the future because we are just scratching the surface. We'd love to hear more, and always a pleasure to visit with you. We want to thank you for taking the time to be with us for a little bit here this evening.
Okay, very good.
All right, thanks so much. The man who couldn't get stalls at Centennial Park, Hall of Fame trainer Bill Mott, our special guest here. All right, we are back tomorrow afternoon, 3 to 7 Eastern Time. Our thanks to Bill Mott for joining us here on Trainer Talk. Thanks for listening, everybody. For our producer, Lee Delapina, and Jude Feld, I'm Mike Pena. We'll talk to you tomorrow on HRN.
Good night, Barbados.